to episode 29 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks, a political scientist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And today I'm just going to be talking about the question of the region putting pressure on the Venezuelan government to hold elections. We're seeing discussion in the OAS almost literally right now, and it's March 28th, and I think that the discussion is going to start at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. This came after Luis Almagro denounced the government, issued a really scathing report, and then he got 14 countries on board, at least rhetorically. So the meeting today is to, quote, consider the situation in the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. Now, you got to remember that there are 35 countries total in the OAS, and despite the fact that the countries that have supported the, at least having this discussion, represent the overwhelming population of the region, size in the OAS doesn't matter as far as creating consensus, and this is in fact why the Venezuelan government has talked about a quote-unquote minority faction. I mean, that's true if you're talking about the membership versus the population. And then if you missed it, also the Venezuelan government actually started the whole process yesterday by having this kind of rambling attack on the OAS and what are by now the pretty familiar conspiracy theories about coups. And Foreign Minister Delcy Rodriguez was delivering this. I watched a little bit. She's the foreign minister. I watched a little bit of it yesterday, and it got eventually kind of hard to watch because she had two guys right behind her who I think were hired almost precisely to start nodding constantly. They were like bobbleheads as she was talking to affirm all the stuff she was saying. So Venezuela came in, tried to have kind of a preemptive attack on the OAS to open up these meetings. Now, what I want to talk about really is the challenge to the region for actually taking action with Venezuela. And there's really two types of analyses that we're seeing. And in general, we're talking about op-eds or what people are saying. One is prescriptive. And the prescriptive type of analysis says, here are the sorts of things that we should do. Here's the sort of thing that the United States should do. Here's the sort of thing that Almagro should do. Here's the sort of thing that the OAS membership should do, whatever. And then the second type of analysis is assessment, meaning what's the likelihood of something happening? What are the interests of the different actors? What are the different members of the OAS interested in? How far will they stick out their necks to do something? Now, at least from what I've seen, is that virtually everything falls into the first category of prescriptive. Here's what we should do. This is actually why I ended up writing the assessment part. I wrote a piece in Latin America Goes Global not long ago, and it was kind of over the top negative, saying that Latin America was never going to unite. Now, I hope I'm wrong, but at least for now, I haven't seen very much evidence that I am. And one thing that I feel the prescriptive types of analyses almost never do is address the key reasons why Latin American countries don't take action. And what I found too is I'm teaching Latin American politics right now, and I've been talking a lot about this in class, is that the default really is that no action is going to be taken. And so, at least in my opinion, the prescriptive types of analyses need to start with that and then figure out, okay, well, what's the likelihood that some of these roadblocks might be overcome? Because otherwise, I mean, sure, we can say this is what you should do, and that's really kind of easy, and maybe it's useful because it keeps the issue in the public eye. But at a certain point, it has a limited type of usefulness in general, because it assumes, or it seems to assume, that there is some general likelihood that, something's going to happen. So what I want to do is talk a little bit about what the obstacles are, because I really do think that we have to start with that before we can even get to a prescriptive part, because I think what the obstacles show is that you would have to have a particular kind of leadership in order to get anything done. And in fact, at least in the OAS, it might well just be impossible. So the first, I have seven different types of obstacles. These aren't really scientific, but they're each distinct. And the first one, looking at what I wrote for Latin America Goes Global, was domestic distractions. So I was kind of over the top talking about, you know, all of the ways in which the presidents, like the Brazilian presidents, in many ways too busy being incompetent in order to really pay attention to anything else. But it's true that the region right now, presidents in the region are dealing with pretty serious domestic issues that could involve corruption, but it also involves economic downturn. And that means they're paying attention to something else. And it's not a great time for them to be expending very much political capital on focusing on a controversial issue abroad, particularly a controversial issue that's not going to generate for them a whole lot of positive consequences. So, you know, if you have Santos, who's dealing with the peace agreements, you have Temer, who's dealing both with corruption issues and economic problems. You know, you just look all around the region, and somebody's dealing with something different. Peña Nieto very obviously has abysmal approval ratings. It's like the lowest practically in the history of the region. And at the same time, he's dealing with the Trump administration. So across the board, presidents have ample reason really not to get potentially mired into a controversial foreign policy issue. The second one is actually a pretty simple one, which is ideology. Now, we know that a number of leftist governments have lost power. There have been transfers from the left more to the right through presidential elections. But ideology isn't gone. Now, I said in my piece that I thought in this case, really ideology should be less important, but that's also kind of prescriptive because, and perhaps naive, in this case, it's like there's a true humanitarian disaster in Venezuela. But still, governments in Ecuador, in Bolivia, at least in Ecuador for now, Bolivia and elsewhere, really can hop on board the idea that this is a push by the right, by somebody who is Almagro, who they believe is too tied to the United States or following the sorts of policies that the United States would support, and kind of plug this into a convenient ideological plug that would say essentially we're just going to stand by our you know, fellow leftist government. And so far, we're seeing that quite a bit. There's a bunch of leftist parties around the region that are supporting the Maduro government. And if we take the question of ideology even more into, you know, concrete terms, then there are many smaller countries that benefited, at least under Hugo Chavez, from oil. Petrocaribe helped them out. And so they feel a certain obligation not to support an effort to, you know, potentially punish the government. And so for them, it's very easy to simply stay back, not support it. And in the, you know, in the OAS, consensus is what matters. And it helps us understand why, so far, a majority of countries in the OAS didn't even support having this discussion today. And when this discussion, I mean, obviously it has condemnation behind it, but it's really just, the point of it is just to even consider it. And a majority of countries don't even really want to do that. I think that alone tells us quite a bit about the possibility of getting a vote ultimately that would actually have some teeth against Venezuela. Reason number three, in terms of naked self-interest, countries, but Latin American presidents, they are afraid of having fingers pointed back at them. This transcends ideology. So if you open the door to having a resolution with teeth, or even a strong sense that Venezuela might be suspended from the OAS because it won't hold elections, then you have presidents that think to themselves, well, I've got all of these problems on my own, corruption perhaps being a big one, and I don't really want the OAS to be able to cast judgment on me. And if this becomes a slippery slope, then you've got a bunch of people who think that this is, this is something that they should oppose simply because it could happen to them. And traditionally, the OAS has, you have to go back a long way when you're dominated in the early Cold War to see it taking sort of strong action like with Cuba. And there's not really a sense that that's a road that they want to renew. And so it's much easier to sort of back off from it. And perhaps like with Brazil, you could support discussions, but you're going to get a little bit more nervous when it comes to actually taking action. Number four is the tradition of anti-intervention. And this one goes deep in the hemisphere. It is connected, of course, to the long history of the United States intervening in Latin America. And so this also transcends ideology, is that just in general, there's a strong hesitation to tell other countries in the hemisphere what to do. And that, tied back to number three, is that this makes people nervous, this idea that we could transform the OAS from a consensual organization to one that that is really going to push very hard about controversial issues. And I noted in a blog post not long ago that Peru, which would be a country you would normally think would be leading the charge, as that PPK has been more outspoken than any other Latin American president, actually about a bunch of issues. And Peru, I think it was the Peruvian foreign minister, said he didn't see much of any chance of action being taken on Venezuela, just because there wasn't going to be consensus. And we're coming back again to the issue of, doesn't matter if the vast majority of the population is living in countries that support these discussions, a majority of the countries that are in the OAS don't support it. And that just means it's far less likely to go forward. And this is actually tied to what I had for number five, which was just the question of consensus, is that even if you got a couple more countries and you boosted yourself over the 18 countries to have a majority, that's not how the OAS works. So you're not going to have a vote that says, well, we've got 18, 20 or whatever countries, if they could scrape a few more together. That's not going to be sufficient in order to take some sort of a major action against Venezuela or any other country. And so you combine that with the anti-intervention tradition, and really you've got a pretty strong barrier to taking action on an issue that's polarizing. There is not consensus about what to do with Venezuela. I have no idea what Rafael Correa or Evo Morales thinks privately. But they don't want to set the precedent of taking action. of intervening. And so if they say no, then that blows apart consensus, and you're kind of stuck. Number six, there is a fear of looking like a stooge or a puppet of the United States. I think this issue is perhaps not necessarily as strong as it used to be, just because the state of affairs in Venezuela is so dire. You have the country, you have Maduro himself already asking for aid from the United Nations. So, at least in my opinion, there's not as much sense that the U.S. is just trying to force this, no matter what the Venezuelan government claims. Other countries can see that, yes, this is actually there's a real problem there, and so they might be willing to vote without fearing that it just looks like the U.S. is pushing all the buttons. But that still stands there. That still sits as a potential problem, that you're not going to want to step into a situation that makes it look like you're just aligning yourself with the United States. And this is especially true when you have the Trump administration, which is deeply unpopular in Latin America, more unpopular than, at least I would assume, than the Bush administration. The Bush administration basically had no influence in Latin America at all. So you don't want to be seen as perhaps standing alongside the Trump administration. So I would see this one perhaps as one type of obstacle, but perhaps not as important as many of the others, and one that is not as critical as perhaps it used to be. The seventh issue, the seventh obstacle, is one that I'm stealing from Chris Sabatini, who had just written a piece about this, and that is that he argues or proposes that what Maduro is doing is sort of institution shopping. So one of the problems, or I should say challenges, that that Latin America has, or certainly the OAS has when it comes to taking action, is that the OAS is no longer the only institution in town. So Maduro is looking to the UN, Maduro is looking to UNASUR, he is looking to CELAC, and if things seem to get kind of too hot in the OAS, then what Maduro could do, very easily actually, is make overtures to one of these other organizations, one that actually is more ideologically favorable to him, and suggest that they help with, for example, promoting dialogue. And dialogue has been pretty much a perfect sort of strategy for the Maduro government, because it generally means that nothing is really going to happen, but that there is at least a PR message of cooperation and goodwill, so that if it seems like the OAS might take action, or at least that the balance is shifting a bit against Venezuela in the OAS, well, then it's not unreasonable to think that he'll push, some other organization will take up the charge, there'll be all of these meetings and discussions about dialogue, and the government gets to kick the can down the road again. It already did this once successfully, and I think to agree with Chris Sabatini is that it's entirely possible to figure out a way to do that again. What do we take from all this? What I think we should conclude is that any effort to explain either what should happen or what's likely to happen in Venezuela, we need to start with the obstacles and then work backward. So, great, you can publish an op-ed saying that Latin America needs to do X, Y, or Z, and that's fine. But it's not telling us a whole lot unless we say, okay, this is the sort of action that specific Latin American leaders, whether they be presidents or whether it be Almagro himself, this is what they can do to actually make this work. And so, as I mentioned, I think one of the problems with the vast number of prescriptive type of analyses is that they give the impression somehow that this is likely. And I think it's much more analytically useful to start with the assumption that it is going to be a Herculean effort, but also, and I concluded my Latin America Goes Global piece with this, was quoting from Simon Bolivar, when once he was giving up on an effort to unify the country, and he backed to what was essentially a realist, if you're thinking about IR theory, but he came back to a realist stance, was that every country go ahead and do what's in your own best interest. And that is the default, and that should always be seen as the default, and it is very rarely in any given Latin American country's interests to take a strong stand against a fellow country because a variety of issues related to self-interest get in the way of that, whether it be self-interest for the country or self-interest for the president himself or herself. So we'll have to see, as I'm talking right now, as things get going in Washington, D.C. with the OAS. And, you know, as always, we'll have to see what happens. I've stated I think nothing eventually will happen. I do hope I'm wrong. I'm happy to admit that and then try to figure out why I was wrong. But, you know, it would have to be miraculous for Latin America to overcome all the obstacles that I have just laid out and actually move in a direction that takes strong action against Venezuela. And with that, I am out of time, and I will stop. And thank you again for listening, and I will be back in another week or two.